Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. 1981 Nobel Prize winner in economics James Tobin, Sterling Professor Emeritus at Yale University, and William C. Brainerd, Arthur M. Oaken, Professor of Economics at the Cowles Foundation, discuss historical and current issues in economics. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Just looking back at some of the things you wrote in the 60s and 70s, and was struck by how current the issues were, how the issues involving inequality and the economic status of blacks and issues of vouchers and so forth were, those are issues then and they're issues now. And I thought I wanted, one of the things I wanted to ask you was how your perception of the problems and the best way to deal with them has maybe changed since that time. I guess improving the economic status of the Negro, you had a kind of analysis of what the reasons were for lower incomes and poor economic outcomes for blacks. And so I was curious how, in the passage of time, your perception or your views of the nature of the problem, the things society can do about them, have changed.
Those things were, that particular article was written at this, in the same years that the Civil Rights Revolution was occurring and actually succeeding in many respects. And so you can see that by the fact that that particular article has the word Negro in it. that changed.
I asked Don Brown if that was okay. He said, yeah, that's okay.
That actually was commissioned or invited by Daedalus, is the magazine of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and they actually turned into a big book of a couple of volumes on all aspects of the situation of blacks in America. Economics is just a minor part of that study. And I was asked to do that. And I protested that I was not an expert, but they said that's what they want, so I did it. And I did write it, and it was sort of my first excursion into this field. So how have things changed? Well, certainly for many, many blacks, but probably a minority of the total population of them, it changed very much for the better. So we see lots more blacks in middle class, upper middle class professions, and so on, and doing very well. And so the civil, and I think general prejudicial attitudes that put them down, for them, the ones that go to college and to graduate school have changed a lot.
Greatly changed, yeah.
But for the majority, things are pretty much the same. The disadvantage that you can see between them and whites in terms of employment, unemployment, wages, and so on, are still there.
Yes, as I just mentioned before, I was really struck that article has a heavy emphasis, maybe not surprising, emphasis on the effects of macroeconomic activity on the welfare of blacks and other folks. And so, as I know you remember, there's a lot of in there about the desirability of running the economy in a relatively high pressure way. But you look at looking at the numbers, I was startled. I got a handout from a recent meeting on things like unemployment rates of blacks and whites age 20, black and white women, black and white teenagers. And what you said in that article seems to be more or less true today. Maybe these elasticities of about one with about twice the...
You just take any demographic group,
right.
Teenagers, young adults, women, men, and so on, and degree of education.
Right.
We'll find the black unemployment rates about twice that of whites.
Right.
There used to be a feeling that blacks were the first fired and the last hired, so that that's an exaggeration, but that meant that if you could get the unemployment rate in total down, you were going to do sort of twice as much for blacks as for whites. So that seemed like the easiest thing to advocate. It didn't require any affirmative action, or but it's sort of automatic. If the economy is really doing well, it lifts maybe not all boats, but it lifts a lot of boats.
Right. Yeah, in fact, that's really one of the things which is quite dramatic in the recent experience. You look at the labor force participation or unemployment, just in the last few years, you've seen, if you could argue, the effect of having a very tight labor market in terms of employment to population ratios for blacks picking up very rapidly, and unemployment rates showing a similar jogs in the most recent data. Where the economy is really humming along. In that article, you talked a fair amount about the effectively a trade-off, which was saying you run the economy a little tighter, you improve the lot of the underprivileged disproportionately, or maybe proportionally, but there's a lot to be done. And then it's what we call pre-Nehru. It's pre the notion that there's some rate of unemployment below which you have accelerating inflation. And so that really has a very explicit trade-off discussed there. I wonder how your views of that have changed since that time, has been the whole controversy about Nehru and natural rate and so forth.
Yes, but of course in 1971 or 72, I gave a presidential address at the American Economic Association and argued essentially that for, let's say, low rates of inflation, when inflation rate is not galloping, when say it's under 5% per year or something like that, there is still a trade-off.
Yeah.
There is still a trade-off, and that, I mean, right now we're trying to get apparently a 0% inflation, maybe lower, and whether that's worth anything or whether it actually is costly. And we could have a somewhat lower rate of unemployment if we had a 2% or 3% inflation.
Yeah, in fact, I still
think that's possible.
Yeah, you argued there, and I guess Akerlof and Perry and Dickens have argued since that they actually may have, given a world with fixed, a lot of nominally-denominated contracts, and it may actually be, and downward nominal rigidities, it may actually be that you improve the allocation resources with a little bit of inflation. I guess the in between, there was kind of a, seemed like there was a period anyway in which the profession at large had the idea of there being a single rate, which was
I think that that theory has suffered a little bit from recent experience.
Quite a bit in the last few
years. Because the single rate that most economists calculated, that was the barrier to reducing unemployment, was pretty high. 6%, I think, was the standard.
Marty Feldstein had it
even
higher.
Years ago, or some people said higher than that.
Right.
And yet, thanks to our pragmatic chairman of the Federal Reserve, Greenspan, we have gone beyond that barrier, and inflation rate has declined.
Right.
While we did. So the natural rate theory, or the Nehru, the so-called non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, not a very good...
Not a very good acronym or whatever.
And not even accurate in terms of, derivatives. But that has gone we've gone way down to maybe 4%. We don't know how low it might may be. It looks more like the 60s when we used to think maybe the we didn't call it the natural rate or the non-accelerating rate, but we did have an idea of what
full employment, what full employment unemployment was.
Full employment unemployment rate was 4%, according to the Kennedy Economic Council.
Yeah, that 4.5 as an interim target.
So I, of course, in the article that you're referring to, I did discuss a lot of the non-macro things that need to be done to equalize the opportunities for blacks in the economy. Right. And so it wasn't all reliance on macro, because even that would leave, even if we got a much higher employment rate, by good luck and good policy in macroeconomics, we still have the differences in skill and education and opportunity, some discrimination, some plain ordinary old racial discrimination still around. I wouldn't count on that being gone forever and completely everywhere in the country, so for sure. So there are a lot of micro aspects of anti-poverty and anti-racial difference proposal.
It's again, it was quite striking looking at this most recent data. And I guess in a way it was a little I found it a little depressing in a way. If you control for things like education, you don't really see, I don't know if you've seen this thing, you don't really see the any noticeable change in the ratio of weekly earnings for a full-time employed black relative to white. In fact, for college graduates, it's actually, in the most recent period, it's actually deteriorated. Actually, it's not. So there undoubtedly has been changes in the proportions of blacks that fall into the lowest education groups and moving towards the black, towards the white proportion.
I think that a big issue that goes beyond what we've just been talking about, which I did bring up in an article and in another article in this same period in the 1960s. What was the
limiting the domains?
No, I meant the well, the one that advocated negative
income tax. Yeah, well, you got several on that.
A negative income tax. Right. Well, so I always thought that it would be necessary and desirable and a duty of a democracy to adjust the inequality that resulted from the market by itself by taxes and transfers to make the ultimate outcome more equal than it would be if you didn't change at all the distribution that came out of market competition. So I think one change in the intellectual atmosphere, political, and also in the economic profession is a rejection by many people of that idea that there is a legitimate reason for and a legitimate purpose in trying to make the distribution less unequal than it would be on its own. That was the proposal to do that actually was also advocated by Milton Friedman, the negative income tax. And actually it has, we're doing it.
Yeah, what's interesting is that...
I was reading the other day a story in the newspaper in the Times about Milwaukee. Where welfare and the old sense, old aid to families of dependent children, to single women with children, that has been repealed by with Mr. Clinton's assent a couple of years ago. And there's, of course, a lot of stories are around about how so many people have been gone off welfare, and some of them have got jobs, so not clear how many. And so this is a story about what happened in Milwaukee, And it was a story about how somehow or other these people, black workers in Milwaukee, a big city, had a lot more cash, and they were even hiring income tax
HR block
helpers. But why were they hiring income tax helpers? In order to qualify for what's it called? The earnings.
Earned income tax credit, or
what? Earnings income tax credit.
Yeah.
EITC, earnings income tax credit, and if you examine the what they were saying about the improvement in the cash resources of these people in Milwaukee who are not in welfare anymore, it's because they had the income tax.
Yeah.
In the form of the EITC.
Yeah.
And that's the reason. Yeah. It's not the repeal of welfare that did it. It's not that they took them out of poverty. It's if anything did, it was the Clinton's proposal back in 1993 to make more generous and the earnings income tax credit.
Yeah, it's as far as evolution, it was striking looking back at what you wrote back in the 60s and the early 70s. There's a strong strand of reliance on generalized increases in income, negative income tax, rather than specific programs aimed at particular poverty, or you're very worried about providing the disincentives for the very high marginal tax rates, which were implicit in the welfare programs at that time.
Yeah, the welfare programs had 100% tax rate.
Or more. Yeah.
You get a dollar from a job, you lose a dollar from your welfare, or more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
So in many ways, the moving away from the welfare programs, traditional welfare programs, is actually consistent with what, but the national concern about the poverty seems much lessened.
Yeah.
Actually, you say the negative income tax elements of what's happened don't get a lot of political play. And you said that there isn't a Nixon advocating FAP or whatever, what's family assistance programs.
I was also concerned about the attitude of the country about redistribution by the use of taxes and transfers. There's a lot of political and cultural resistance to doing that, so it's never done with a great deal of generosity.
Yeah.
As you may recall, in the 1972 political campaign, I was an advisor to George McGovern, and we
had a scheme.
We prevailed on him. The team prevailed upon him to actually to propose such a program,
and
a means-tested incentive with a lot of incentives in it for work and for marriage and for staying in one place and not migrating and so on. So we had these proposals, which McGovern got.
Well, he kind of bungled, right?
He bungled his explanation of them, and.
And he got started on it before he got your advice, is the way I remember it.
That's right, and at any rate, he went out to California with his only with his political advisors, and they could not explain to him how to explain it in public. So he got. Scorned and laughed at.
Because of the consequences for Humphrey's secretary or something, wasn't that the...
Well, it's sort of the idea of a demogrant.
Yeah.
You say a guaranteed kind of income that everybody has a right to. You've got a bad beating in politics. But later, Nixon actually proposed much the same thing.
Yeah.
He didn't get it, but he had proposed it. So. We had to wait for the EITC to get something like that, and it's pretty much the way it is now. But in thinking about this, I got thinking that the populace as a whole is willing to tolerate a lot of inequality, provided it's not in essentials, in what the people regard as essentials. So people will not get so much worried about people having yachts,
right,
or fancy cars,
right, ski vacations.
But they will worry about people having more health care than other people have, or more to eat than other people have, or better schools than other people have. Yeah. So,
well, is it really the more, or is it just have the idea that there's a, that everyone should have some acceptable level?
Yeah, some acceptable level, and then the question is whether allowing other people to have, the people with a lot of money, right, to have, right, more,
right,
deprives people of the acceptable, right, level. So, right, you know, that depends on what you think about the what economists would call the elasticity of supply.
Yeah.
So if,
right,
if there are a lot of potential doctors who can do plastic surgery for, right, for aesthetic and reasons, and then we might not care so much about whether rich people choose, right, to use their riches that way rather than buying a big car.
Right.
But if there is a shortage of physicians in general or physicians of that particular kind, we might worry about.
Worry about ratio. And then that, in that article, Living in the Main, you had, you know, the war items seemed scarce at the time, and you talked explicitly that there was no reason they would be in the longer run. For example, housing, I think, is one that you,
yeah,
talk about, which is that there's no, there can be a period of time when you say there really is an issue of a relatively fixed stock, and you'd be, but it's hard to believe that in the long run that's really a something which is fixed supply. It has to be rationed out in some way across the population. So you feel that way now about how about medical care, which is, you know, I either think that the population still has a view that you ought to have the right to buy medicine, medical care beyond the political population, beyond some minimal level, but there's a lot of sentiment that people should have some minimal level.
Yes, well, I think that's the more important thing, is to, yeah, be sure that, that there is equality at some level, and so that a safety net, so to speak, yeah, which has to be pretty high in the case of medical care.
Yeah.
I mean, now we're talking about having Medicare packages that include drugs.
Prescription drugs, for example.
Prescription drugs.
Right.
And that's really essential, since, as far as I can see, the being a consumer of medical care sometimes,
yeah,
drugs are the main thing that doctors do.
Yeah.
Prescribe drugs.
But on the other hand, you think of the drug, you sort of say, where is it that the, where's the market failure in a way? You know, it's clear that no individual could take care of catastrophic, again, not, maybe it's not clear, but it is, there are predictable kinds of expenses which you have for medical and non-medical. You say, why we use the market for many of those. I always thought it was a bit of an irony that we have a system where we, and take it within a university health plan, where you actually have complete insurance for all the inexpensive things,
yeah,
and incomplete insurance
for a catastrophe.
Yeah,
that's
for a catastrophe. Catastrophe.
Yeah.
So it's and that is a curiosity in the way these dental plans and medical plans are constituted.
Yeah, and when I think President Reagan actually was one who proposed to give up some of the humdrum,
right,
availability of, yeah, medical care in order to have complete catastrophic care,
yeah,
and this was in the Medicare for,
yeah,
old people, and the constituency wouldn't, yeah, wouldn't have it.
Yeah, it's a curiosity because it really is. Yeah. If you said if I had my druthers, I would say that's the first thing I'd worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, of course, it's you know, it's true the large fraction of the elderly will have things which are close to catastrophic, a much higher percentage, but it's still true a lot don't. And you say the highest priority you think would be to take care of those.
Yeah. But go back to the wider issues. I guess I'm a little concerned about the idea that's prevalent in even in our profession these days, or maybe mostly in our profession,
yeah,
I don't,
yeah,
know,
probably,
that that there's nothing wrong with the distribution of income that comes out of unfettered markets, right. And there's no reason to try to adjust it in any particular way. And I noticed one of the big prestige lectures at the American Economic Association meetings a year or so ago was in defense of wealthy people or something like that. No.
In defense of inequality.
In defense of inequality, right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I noticed, for example, that both parties in the Congress and the presidency are enchanted with tax credits.
Yeah.
Tax credits for this, tax credit
right.
for that.
Right.
And the but the idea that only the people who are right. rich enough to
take advantage
of tax liability should get
right.
the benefit.
Yeah.
That seems to be taken as just and right.
Yeah.
And otherwise, the tax credits would be made what we'd call refundable.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the original idea right. of the negative income
negative
tax,
taxes.
That it shouldn't be that you give, say, $500 a child
right.
to people who have a tax liability, but you
not
don't
zero
give
it, if you don't.
But you don't right. give it to other people.
Yeah. Well, was Friedman?
Friedman himself
bought onto this.
Yes, yeah. yes, he was in favor of that.
Yeah.
So, but that's the ruling right. ethic in Washington about this
yeah.
matter. This matter now. So, tax credits are for taxpayers. That's what they said. So, I guess I've always taken you could call a utilitarian view about distribution and redistribution, namely, like Ab Lerner, who said, "Well, we don't know how to compare your marginal utility of consumption with mine, or with Richard Ruggles, or anybody else's. Though I expect you are a very, very sensitive consumer, a lot of utility,
a lot of utility per dollar.
per dollar.
It's been alleged,
at least on average. but we don't know. We don't have any way of making a judgment
as to whether comparison, yeah.
a dollar more would give you more
pleasure,
extra you. Satisfaction yeah. than it would give to somebody on the other side of town. Lerner says, but in the absence of any other hypothesis,
why not just assume it's equal?
Why not assume that people are
right.
more likely to be alike than
right,
to be different in
right.
their capacity
to generate utility from resources?
In that case, the margin of utility is higher for people who are poorer,
right.
so there would be an advantage to the society as a whole if the transfer would be made. But then there are the practical utilitarian reasons not to do it, namely that the incentives for work and for saving and for risk taking and so on have to be maintained. So they need to be, that means the compromise that has
right.
to be made.
Right.
But there are a lot of people who think that doesn't need to be any compromise.
I wonder what a Oaken-Leaky Bucket experiment would show if you ever did the survey. We got to get Bob Schiller to run one of those surveys, which was a fascinating introspection by which he suggested this to look at in which you found economists at that time would be prepared to take from a 75th percentile household and give to a 25th percentile household if only a modest fraction of what was taken was actually delivered, either because of incentive effects or
yeah.
bureaucracy or whatever. It'd be fun to have, it's kind of a wild thing to have, but a survey of attitudes about distribution through those kinds of, we have to get children to do those kinds of, he's willing to do those kinds of things, which economists have scorned.
But there's a stronger view in our profession as well as elsewhere that that keeping your income is a matter of right, it's not a matter of
calculation.
Social strategy and
not,
calculation.
Yeah, it's not a question of calculating deadweight losses and efficiencies. Yeah, it's
that's certainly an increasing view.
The strand which of argument which you emphasize actually in some of these earlier pieces, and I'm sure it's still true in a bit, but it's very relevant to current discussions, is the extent to which children are deserve equal opportunities, and the extent to which opportunities are really influenced by the economic status of parents.
Yeah, that's. I think there's this this belief and claim by many people who use it as a justification for the inequality that exists, namely that what we're interested in and in this democracy is equality of opportunity and not the equality of outcome. But that is a phony or false distinction, in my opinion, if you reflect that that the opportunity of the next generation of young children and young adults depend on the their opportunities, and their inequality of opportunity depends on the inequality of the outcomes of their parents. So that certainly those who are lucky enough to be brought up by wealthy parents are going to have a lot of head start, not just the program and the government, but head start all through their childhood and education. And their inheritance is not in cash, not in property, but in ability and
dinner table conversation and
yes, and contacts
and yeah. Access to books and computers and all manner of things.
So we have especially an obligation, if we believe in equality of opportunity, to do a lot more than we do to make it be a realistic thing and not just a slogan.
A curiosity, I don't remember this that well, but I don't remember the constitutional debates at the state level about equal access to education back in the 60s and 70s. Much more was federally oriented, and the federal government wasn't as heavily involved in education, which was a local, locally provided, state and local.
Well, it was state because the states usually are the government that has the constitutional obligation.
Yeah, but most
provide
of the,
education.
But in fact, most school districts and revenues are local. So you have this anomaly where you are. Curiosity, which is, you say state constitutions, but local school boards and local tax bases.
Yes, but those are given to the local school boards and local governments by the state. So that the state was the target of the suits that were brought by people who thought that the state should be active in equalizing.
Yeah, but so I actually don't remember so much about the those suits back in the period we're talking about, but they're very big right now.
Yeah, they've
the last 10 years or so.
A revival.
Yeah. And in fact, I think of it as being an encouraging thing. It's caused a holy hell up in Vermont, where the state Supreme Court ruled the local property taxes, the local system financed, unconstitutional under the Vermont Constitution.
Or if you just look at the way it is in Connecticut, our own state, where if you take the statewide exams that are given to school children at fourth grade and eighth grade in math and reading, and then and look and see how many students pass them.
Right.
And in New Haven Public Schools, it's like 20%.
Yeah, is that right?
And in the suburban public schools, it's like 60%.
Yeah.
So now that, a lot of that is the resources in the schools. A lot of that is the resources in the home. Families, right. In the home.
Right.
Yeah. So in New York City, the same kind
of problem. It's probably an educator's bias, but somehow if you think of the long run problems of poverty, they seem to be ones which are tied. If you think of the single instrument, which is most important in changing,
the most important
is probably education.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Not
easy.
Yeah. Now, well, I was going to ask you what your current view is of vouchers as a way of financing education and providing freedom of choice and allegedly competition by schools to provide more efficient.
You mean?
Some people are advocating for a variety of reasons, but advocating the granting of vouchers, the use of tax revenues to give vouchers to parents and giving the parents some choice.
Yeah, it seems to me that all too often those proposals are a proposal to pick up with government funds the tuition that the fathers and mothers are paying to a Catholic school or some other private school already.
Right.
So what we're doing is giving them a free ride to do what they would do anywhere. All too many things that we enact in state legislatures and in the Congress have that characteristic. That they do a lot more to subsidize people who are doing some particular activity,
right,
which is desirable,
right,
than they do to spreading the
help the folks who are, right,
to other people. So I also worry about the public schools becoming the dumping ground for the most difficult students,
right,
most difficult.
Most cost to educate.
Intellectually, right, and behaviorally.
Right. Right.
And if you give government money to a school that can kick them out, right, when they don't behave, then that's what happens. And then you argue, well, see, those schools are a lot better. And the public schools would be better too if they could pick and choose whom they would have in the school. So I think that's a big problem. And if you're going to give away public money, you have to insist on that the people who receive it and administer have to have the same comprehensive representative admissions.
Yeah,
but the retention policies, right, as the public schools do.
You'd also have to have sufficient resources in the voucher so that people could afford, if you will. You can have sorting by dollars as well as sorting by some other principle of you call it cream skimming or whatever. But and most of these plans are not sufficient to take a person from a public school and fully finance.
One thing worries me about the unpopularity of affirmative action these days is going back to our discussion about opportunity and inequality or equality of opportunity. If at what point do you assume that the original advantages and disadvantages due to birth and parents' wealth and so on are erased, so that you should just look at the exam scores.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't make sense if you have exam scores for three-year-olds to decide who goes to a good nursery school.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
They don't have a chance to have equality of opportunity. Right. If you come to ask who should be allowed to go to a prestigious law school,
right,
where the candidates include graduates of all kinds of colleges, then there may be more sense in saying by that time
you should have
the previous education should have
washed out the unequal opportunities at the beginning of life.
Yeah,
right.
And so you have less reason to say that who's going to get an internship with a Supreme Court justice should be done on a basis other than
merit
by itself.
Right.
And but
as you said, every example shows that this is not such a clear issue. You'd say
no.
Unless you somehow believe that the moment of conception, from then on, it's a everything that happens to you is a consequence of your own actions. So I was thinking that the voucher plans or these education reforms have the same kind of problems we're talking about with medical care. This is a very hot issue in Vermont, where the state is now going to provide a certain amount of expenditure per student for each school district on the basis of essentially a statewide property tax, but then allows individual communities to have a so-called local share tax and tax beyond it. And I think what you find there is that the tax rate that they've imposed on the state tax on the local tax has gotten people very exercised. I think it may be done a little capriciously. So you have tax rates. If you raise a dollar of tax revenue beyond what the state gives you in poor districts, you get back more than a dollar per dollar you raise off of your own district. But in the wealthy, in the gold towns, Warren and Killington and Stowe, you pocket only like 16 cents on a dollar.
That doesn't seem so bad to me.
16 cents? I think maybe a half. I don't know.
Okay, yeah, maybe a half, yeah. Well, it's like the on a smaller, more homegrown example is when in the New Haven schools, if you live in your district of New Haven, then you think, well, gee, it would be nice if our kids were getting
after-school programs,
French after-school, something like that, or better computers, and so on. So the PTA then thinks about doing that.
How much should we be allowed to do without having to make sure everybody else in the city gets to do it?
Shouldn't you have to pay a little tax to?
Yeah, I agree. You should have a little tax.
Some tax to let the same things happen in other schools.
Right. Well, in fact, you can't avoid that tension, right? I mean, if you're going to have a statewide constitution, you're going to have something which tends to equalize across the districts and doesn't allow local districts to just opt out and everybody vote for low taxes and then finance their local
in Connecticut. In Connecticut, there's been a suit in the courts about equality of provision of by the state for resources for education within the city of Hartford, for example, compared with the outside the city. But everything that has been done as a result of that is purely voluntary by the by the suburban, exurban school districts, and
that's not much
that happens there.
Well, it really is. I think it's a curiosity of our political system, right? Where you have these clear state. We have a federal constitution, but in this case, it's a clear state constitution with state responsibility for equal educational access. But you have also a tradition of local control and indeed local taxes to support local schools.
Perfect. And this also gets into the bigger issues of progressive income taxation to begin with. And we certainly have reduced the top marginal tax rate of the federal income tax a lot in the last 20 years. So and now it's amazing how well the country did when it had
It's amazing that
those confiscatory.
It's amazing how the whole Clinton tax increases have allow the economy to grow. But I think on this constraining of expenditures beyond the minimum level or taxing them is a surprisingly contentious. I don't know. It's maybe not surprise. It's a very contentious issue. It's contentious on medical care. It's contentious on education.
I'll never forget that I was invited to be on a program of debating all these ethics of redistribution issues, and one of my conservative opponents in the debate. It was just after I'd been fortunate to get the Nobel Prize.
I see this coming.
and this conservative debater was arguing that, well, anybody who has a taste for redistribution could do it himself.
Do his bit.
Just send a check to other people, and he says, and I believe that Professor Tobin is now in a
position to do so.
I thought that was a pretty below the belt comment. Actually, I think also that it misses the point, which is that one could be in favor of
collective
of a measure of redistribution which everybody would participate in, and not believe that you could get any this appreciable social result by trying to do it on your own if nobody else is going to join you. So it's called the isolation paradox,
right.
Something like that. And these people seem to have no understanding of that at all.
Yeah. Well, a good coffee session, Jim.
Well, we always do in this room. Every morning we solve all the problems of the world.
Yeah. We solve them several times. I can't figure out why they're still there.
Somehow they don't stay.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.